Thank you for joining today's special Election Watch event. In just over 7 months, voters will head to the polls to determine the policy fate of our country. But this election has implications not only for the United States, but also the rest of the world and financial markets as well. Within our UBS Chief Investment Office, we've been covering the impact through our Election Watch series. But today, we'll continue the conversation with experts across the political, geopolitical and financial worlds for three short discussions. First, we'll be joined by Frank Kelly to dive into the state of the race and key policy considerations. Frank is a 30-year veteran of Wall Street and DC, founder of Fulcrum Macro Advisors, a political risk advisory firm, and senior political strategist for DWS. After, Frank will zoom out and discuss what this election means beyond borders, as the race coincides with a tense and quickly evolving geopolitical landscape. We'll be joined by Admiral Mike Rogers, who served as director of the National Security Agency when President Biden was VP, and then under former President Trump. Finally, in our last discussion, we will be joined by David Rubenstein, co-founder and co-chairman of Carlyle Group. And he's a man of many talents as a philanthropist, show host, author, and newly minted sports team owner. David will help us bring everything together to assess what the election means for investments. And of course, if we have some time, we might actually squeeze in a question around Baltimore Orioles. All right, so we have lots to cover, and let's get right into it. Frank, I'm turning to you first. Welcome, and thank you for kicking us off today. Thank you. I really want to start by level setting where we are in the presidential campaign. I mean, it has become really harder to trust the polling in the recent years. That said, what can we glean from early data, especially relating to some of the battleground states? Because as we know, the last few elections have really come down to a handful of them.
Well, it is interesting, right, that we're seeing these polls and they seem to be so strongly in favor of President Trump for the moment. I would say this, though. Let's remember, it's early April. We've got a long way to go. There's a lot of issues out there happening, both domestically and geopolitically. And it's, I think this is so timely to have Admiral Rogers join this as well. So we saw the Wall Street Journal, the poll, which was probably the biggest one most recently released, where former President Trump is leading in 6 out of 7 battleground states. And while everybody is divining this as terrible news for President Biden, it's not good. There's no sugarcoating it. I think we could expect a lot of shifts between now and November. I'd also say this. I do sense, and I actually was just in Iowa yesterday doing some client meetings, and it's very interesting. There's a fatigue out there among voters, right? That they have just been polled and polled and polled, and here it is April, and they just want to. We've just got through a cold winter. I'm not certain people are truly set in stone. So that's one thing to keep in mind. So the accuracy of polls, I think, it's more like Jell-O. It's kind of shaking. It's kind of all over the place. Well, let's wait and see if it firms up. Conversely to that, I'd say the big question is, where do a lot of minority voters go? And I think that's sort of the shock thing that we're seeing out of the polls, African-Americans and Latinos seeming to gravitate to President Trump.
Okay. So maybe if we move up to some of the issues that will decide the race, we all know the famous saying from the Clinton campaign, it's the economy, stupid. right? But this time around, it seems a lot more complicated than that. On one hand, the sentiment around the economy is not matching up with the strength of the data. Issues like immigration are also likely to play maybe a much bigger role. So what do you believe will determine the outcome?
I think there is this sense that the economy is not where it should be among a lot of people, defying what all the data is saying out there, and certainly what the markets are doing. There may be a catch-up effect to this, right, that we get to the middle of summer and people are feeling a little bit better, particularly if Jay Powell and the Fed start lowering rates. But this is a race against time, I would argue, for Democrats, because if this doesn't change, certainly by June or July, I think there's going to be a serious problem for them come November. But I also think there's going to be regional issues here that will play out. Abortion continues to be an issue in polls, and that depends on where you are and what state you're in. Immigration is everywhere in terms of as a hot button issue. As I mentioned, there was an IOE yesterday. I got more questions about what is going on in the border in Fort Dodge, Iowa, than I ever expected. I think that's going to continue to be a big issue. Other big issues will be crime, and I think also the geopolitical issues, right? You're seeing what's happening in Gaza as a big issue for President Biden right now in polls among his base.
Okay, and we're going to dive into some of the geopolitical issues with Admiral Rogers in a little bit. Frank, of course, you know, the presidency is not the only upcoming election. How do you see the Senate and the House races playing out?
Well, this is what's going to really matter, I think, for the markets ultimately into the day. At this point, my base case is 60% plus that the House representatives actually flips to Democrats. You've got such a thin majority for Republicans at this point, and between the issues that they have had to deal with in terms of internal fighting among Republicans and redistricting in a number of states, it's going to be very hard for them to hold on. We'll see. Again, it's April. It's very early. Conversely, you look at the Senate, and I think that probably 60% probability or higher flips to Republicans, as a number of Democrats in very red states are up for re-election. It's going to be tough for them to hold on in Ohio, Montana, increasingly Wisconsin. West Virginia is almost certainly going to go Democrat to Republican. So I think that's probably how that's going to play out. And of course, that all means so much for tax issues and other issues in 2025, 2026.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the investments a little bit later, but I guess a divided government probably be better for the markets. If we just maybe fast forward 4 years after the election, what they might look like. Both Biden and Trump have used fiscal stimulus in different but significant ways, but the economy looks a lot different than it did in 2017 or even in 2021. So what is realistic in terms of, Frank, taxes and spending under either candidate?
Well, for both parties, there's going to have to be this come to reality moment here of what are we doing with the deficits? And I think this is going to the first battle line of that. Nobody wants to talk about that in an election year because that gets us into entitlement reform, which is the fastest way to become an unemployed politician. But in 2025 and beyond, we're going to have to talk about Social Security reform, Medicare reform. What are we doing there? As these are rapidly hitting deadlines coming up in the coming years of being bankrupt. So we're going to have to do something about that. And then conversely, the ongoing pressure for industrial policy, right? Reshoring, nearshoring. What are we doing to bring back these critical industries, which are so attractive and are so important to our national economy, but also our state economies in terms of semiconductors and pharmaceuticals, manufacturing, all of that. We've got a real dilemma here, and there's going to have to be some very hard choices made in the next 4 or 5 years. What are we going to do, and how are we going to do them?
Okay. I want to move on to foreign policy, because it's obviously front and center. Do you think some of the most extreme proposals, like Trump's 10% universal tariff, could become a reality if elected?
I think in many ways these could be more threats, if you will, than reality. I think there'll be a lot of pushback from industry on that because of the adverse effect it will have on U.S. exports. It's always possible, though. I think, you know, the one thing we know about former President Trump is there is an unpredictable factor to him, and he likes to work with that. So it could be real. I'm dubious that he actually would go the full 10%. So we'll have to wait and see. And that, of course, that's if he gets elected.
Great. Thank you very much, Frank. It's very insightful. I think the points that we talked about earlier around geopolitics is actually a good segue for the next conversation, as I mentioned earlier, heading into the elections. So I'm pretty pleased to bring in Admiral Mike Rogers. Okay,
thanks.
Here you are, Mike.
A pleasure to be with you.
Great to be with you. Thank you for joining us. And of course, thank you for your service as well.
I should be thanking you. I got to do something I loved and always wanted to do.
That's great. So, Admiral Rogers, you've been all over the globe recently, from China to Israel to Australia and more. My question to you is, how is the rest of the world looking at this election?
Everywhere I go, I get three questions about the election. Number one, who's going to win? Number two, could you help us understand what is going on? Because we find the dynamic as we watch you, the United States, it's perplexing to us, and we're a little confused by the rhetoric. And a kind of secondary, how did you wind up with these two individuals as the primary candidates? And then thirdly, and probably the one that is of the greatest concern to most people I see globally, is so if President Trump were to win re-election, what would that mean for U.S. policy towards my nation, my region, the issues that I care about? I'm in Tel Aviv as I'm speaking to you, and I have, in the last week, been bombarded with, what would the difference in U.S. policy towards Gaza and Israel in general be under President Trump versus a President Biden, depending on who won?
Okay. Big questions. So in an earlier conversation, we touched on evolving trade dynamics, but more broadly, how do you expect the relations between U.S. and China to evolve in the coming years?
So remember, President Trump, during his presidency, was the individual who kind of started us down this more aggressive, hey, we need to confront China, we need to be more direct, and we need to use leverage as a vehicle to attempt to change certain aspects of Chinese behavior. So I would fully expect if he wins, he would still be committed to that, as if President Biden were to win re-election, I would believe that he too would be committed to this fundamental idea we have to continue to press China more. President Biden tended to view technology and economic policy as the best ways to try to change China's behavior, working in partnership with others. President Trump, and I worked for President Trump, and I got to work with President Biden very closely when he was vice president. President Trump, during his time, seemed to believe, hey, look, we need to confront China more aggressively. We'll do it with technology, but he seemed to believe trade and tariff policy broadly is really the best vehicle to try to change China's behavior in certain areas.
Okay. And then, you know, obviously this election is coming at a pivotal time for global security, with the two wars going on with Russia-Ukraine and Israel-Hamas, and you mentioned that you're actually joining us from Tel Aviv today. How do you see the election impacting these conflicts?
Well, clearly, I think everyone's looking to see, does an election represent in some ways either a fundamental shift in U.S. policy with respect to Ukraine, China, Israel? And then also, I think people are trying to ask themselves, can we count on America to be fully, whoever wins, can you count on the United States to be fully engaged and to be fully committed? You get that very much in the Ukraine scenario, and you get that very much in the Gaza scenario right now.
Okay. And then one last question I have for you, Admiral Rogers. I mentioned earlier that you worked both with Trump and Biden. So what is the overall key takeaway you would leave our audience with in terms of how either candidate would impact American foreign policy?
So President Biden believes strongly that an America that is engaged aggressively in the broader world is a good thing for the United States as well as for the broader world that we're a part of. And that the best way for America to be aggressively engaged with that broader world is to do it in a multilateral kind of framework, to do it in partnership with others. When I worked for President Trump, I would say his slightly different. His view was America should be selectively engaged in issues where our core national security interests are at stake. So, for example, it's one of the arguments he has made about Ukraine, arguing, is it really a core national interest for the United States? Is the level of effort, financial support, commitment, et cetera, is it really justified? And the other thing that you heard from President Trump when I worked for him was, he felt very strongly that America's strength was underestimated by some nations around the world, and that therefore America should feel more comfortable acting unilaterally on issues that it felt strongly about, that America, and by extension, he as the president, believed were important to our nation's security. So two very different kind of visions, which is one reason why that third question I always get, what would be the difference if President Trump were one, particularly in Europe? I mean, Europe is the area I think that I visit, I spend time in around the world that seems to be the most concerned about, would a President Trump victory fundamentally change the nature of the relationship between the United States and Europe, the United States and NATO, the Ukraine issue, et cetera?
Yeah, definitely less interest in allyship in that case. Thank you, Admiral Rogers, for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Great. And now for our final session, we'll discuss what this all means for investments. And I'm very pleased to be joined here in our New York office by David Rubenstein. Welcome. Great to have you here.
My pleasure.
So I'll just get right into it. How do you believe the election could impact financial markets, and how should the clients invest in such an election year?
Well, there's always a tendency to want to have advance information, legal advance information, and to know what's going to happen in the future. But the truth is, it's probably not a great idea to invest 6 months in advance based on how you think an election might happen, because generally you might be wrong and therefore you might make a mistake. As a general rule of thumb, I think it's best to kind of not assume that if the Democrats win, it's going to be a certain economy, a certain way, or if the Republicans win, it's going to be a certain economy, a certain way. Over the last 75 years, the economy has been roughly the same GDP growth-wise if it's a Democratic administration or Republican administration. Over the last 75 years, the average GDP growth under a Democratic administration has been roughly 6.6% per annum. Under a Republican administration, roughly 6.4. So the difference is infinitesimal, honestly. So I don't think it'll make that much difference. Similarly, if the Congress is all in one party, it doesn't really mean that a united government's going to go a certain way and everything's going to be better. Actually, the GDP growth is better when you have divided government. So I would tell people, don't try to worry about where the economy is going to be 6 months or 8 months in advance. You're going to probably be wrong if you try to predict where it's going to go because of the election outcome.
Yeah. In every one of our reports, we say don't vote with your portfolio. Express your view with your votes, not with your investment selection.
My general view of the investment world and this kind of thing for most investors is the most important thing you can do is pick a good money manager who has a good track record, appropriate fees, disclosure, and so forth. That is going to be a bigger difference in your rate of return than anything else, trying to predict the elections or so forth.
Yes. Music to our ears. So we know the president and Congress are not the only policymakers in town, David. All eyes obviously have been on the Fed. Do you believe the election will play into their decision-making at all?
Well, the Federal Reserve are composed of humans, so naturally they're not going to be unaware of what's going on. But I think to the extent that they want to have some eye on the election, it is to not be in the middle of the election campaign. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that they do have rate cuts, I'm pretty sure they'd want to get them out of the way before the election campaign really heats up. In this country, presidential election campaigns historically start after Labor Day. So my guess is the Federal Reserve would like to have its cuts, assuming they do it, and they said they would, yeah, out of the way before September. Because after September, they start making rate cuts. It's clear that people will criticize them, saying you're trying to help the Democrats or something. And President Trump has already said something to that effect. So I think the rate cuts, if they're going to come, and I'm sure they will probably be before September.
Yeah. And, I mean, time is running out a little bit. It just gives a very short window between June and September. But
it's a short window, but the Fed can do it, obviously. And they've telegraphed that they're going to do three rate cuts, more or less. But they can change their mind. As Jay Powell likes to say, he's very data-driven, and the Fed is data-driven. So the data shows something different than what they anticipated. They'll probably do something different than what they previously said. But based on what they have today, I suspect they feel three rate cuts or two or three rate cuts will be done, and I suspect before the Labor Day.
Labor Day. Great. Thank you. So if you put the election aside for a second, earlier in our conversation, we covered some of the geopolitical tension points in this multipolar world. At Carlyle, you invest across geographies. So how does this play into your investment decisions?
Well, geopolitical events that are unanticipated have an impact in the short term because people are surprised and they react adversely typically. We have three geopolitical events going on right now, you could argue, and they're well anticipated by the market, so I don't think there's going to be a big surprise, anything happening there. They are Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, and China, Taiwan. And right now, I think things pretty much are known where they're likely to be over the next couple months, not for certain, but I don't think anything happening, any of those three geopolitical things is likely to dramatically change the markets because it's unlikely something dramatic is going to happen there. If something were to happen in a part of the world that we didn't anticipate, then it'll have some impact on the markets. But generally, these geopolitical events probably don't dramatically change the stock market or dramatically change the investment outlook.
Okay. So not necessarily inflection points, but maybe short-term volatility. So one consequence of the geopolitical tensions has been the renewed focus on critical infrastructure spending. Some would say that U.S. finally has an industrial policy for the first time since 1970s, 80s. How do you see this feeding through opportunities in private markets?
Well, infrastructure is deteriorated in this country. If anybody travels to other parts of the world, Abu Dhabi or Singapore are good examples, or Hong Kong, you see infrastructure that's unlike anything we have in the United States. You have to explain to people in some parts of the world what a pothole is. You don't have to explain to people in the United States what a pothole is. So our infrastructure has fallen behind. The infrastructure legislation that passed is great, but it will take a long time to get something done. And we saw when the bridge collapsed the other day in the Baltimore area that that will take a long time to fix. These things take a long time to fix. That bridge took 5 years to build, may take almost that long to fix it. And so when you're talking about airports or telecommunications infrastructure or bridges or roads, you're talking about 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road. So I think it's a great area in which to invest, and a lot of great investments have been made there, assuming you're recognized you're going to get high single-digit, low double-digit rates of return on average.
If we just stay on this topic of geopolitics, I read a quote from you that one of the biggest risks is actually right here in the United States, and it's government dysfunction. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, the famous cartoon, the Al Cap cartoon, was, "I've seen the enemy and it's us." So I think I worry more about the fact that our country can't really govern itself that effectively in Congress, because as you see, we have a crazy situation now. For example, the Republicans in the House of Representatives have roughly a 2-seat majority, but they're running like as if they have a fit. They're operating it as if they have a 50-seat majority. You can't really get things through with the 2-seat majority very easily. Yet they don't seem to be changing their tactics very much. When you have to worry about whether your debt limit bill is going to pass or whether the government has to be funded, that's a serious waste of time because the government has to fund itself and we have to have the debt limit. But going through the machinations, I think, makes people around the world say, why do you want me to have your type of democracy? You tell me my democracy is not good or my government's not good. You guys cannot even fund your own government. So it's very hard for us to tell people around the world that they should follow our lead when we can't even run our own government.
Yeah. So you just mentioned that obviously one issue that will take some level of bipartisanship is addressing our national debt. I mean, many prominent figures in our industry, from Jamie Dimon to Larry Fink, has been sounding the alarm. How concerned are you at this moment, and what do you think the impact could be?
Well, I like to think that all of my gray hair came about worrying about the debt. When I left the White House under Jimmy Carter, we had roughly $800 billion of debt. When the country was set up, we had $70 million of debt. When I left the White House, $800 billion. Now we have roughly $35 trillion. So there's nothing to worry about in the sense that if we keep doing what we're doing, we're just going to have a higher percentage of our government going to paying interest. And that's not a good thing. This daisy chain will come to an end when people say they don't want to buy our dollars anymore. Right now, the United States does not have a sovereign wealth fund. We have a printing press, and we keep printing dollars, and people keep buying them. At some point, when people say, I don't want those dollars because they're going to be devalued so much, they aren't going to buy them anymore. And so I don't know when that's going to be, 5 years or 10 years from now, but at some point, people will stop buying our dollars the way they stopped buying the British pound or the Dutch guilder many, many centuries ago. So I do worry about that. But for the foreseeable future, I don't think Washington's going to change or New York's going to change in terms of our ability to fund this debt. If we're paying our budget each year is roughly one-third is almost debt. And every deficit every year is about one-third debt. And, you know, you can do that for a while, but not forever.
Yeah. We need interest rates to stay low or lower.
Well, when interest rates were low, we didn't pay that much attention to it. But with interest rates being relatively high, we're paying almost as much in interest as we're paying in the defense expenditure of our country.
You talked about the dysfunction in our government, but you've also made it a point to try to bring policymakers together. In fact, I think you're hosting an ongoing bipartisan dinner. Can you maybe give our audience a seat at the table and touch on why you're doing this and what have you learned from it?
Well, for the last 8 years, roughly once a month, I host a dinner for members of Congress only, though they can bring a guest. And I ask them to sit with people from the opposite party and the opposite house so they get to know people better than they otherwise would. And I typically interview a great American historian to give people who are making our laws a greater sense of our history. The theory is if people who make our laws know more about our history, maybe the laws would be better. But also, I really want to have people to come together. And members of Congress tell me, maybe this is sad, this is the most interesting thing they're doing in Congress, is going to these dinners. Now, you would think that they're passing legislation would be more interesting, but they like these dinners because they get to talk with people from the opposite party and the opposite house. Right now, we don't have conference committees anymore. It used to be when legislation was passed one, the House or the Senate, they have a conference committee. Almost all the legislation now is done in the leadership offices. There are virtually no conference committees to speak of. And as a result, members of the House and Senate don't really work with each other that much anymore. And there aren't congressional delegations going abroad anymore because of the controversy of them. So most of these people in the House and the Senate don't know each other. And many people who are Democrats or Republicans are not really allowed to be seen in public having lunches or dinners with people from the opposite party. So there's no press here. And so people can come and be seen with people in the opposite party and not have to worry that somebody's going to criticize them for it. So I think I've learned that members of Congress want to do the right thing, but they're in a system that is really constraining their ability to do so.
Is there a wait list for this? I'm sure.
Well, if you want to come, let me know.
All right. We'll do. We'll do. David, you clearly have a lot of passion for our country, which also shows through how you spend both your time and your money. And you've built a reputation as a patriotic philanthropist. What does this mean and why is it important?
Well, I coined the term patriotic philanthropy to connote what I was trying to do with some of my philanthropy, which is to remind people of the history and heritage of our country. The theory is if you know more about the past, you're not likely to make the same mistakes as you made in the past. And that's the reason we want to learn about history. And right now, many people in our country don't know much about the government, the way it operates, or civics, or things like that. Now, I can tell from your accent that you were probably not born in the Bronx. Is that right?
No.
Where were you born?
Istanbul.
Okay. So are you a naturalized American?
Yes.
Okay. To be a naturalized American, you have to pass a citizenship test.
Yes.
And you typically have to pass 10 questions. And if you're over 65, they tell you exactly which 10 questions they're going to give you. You're obviously not in that category. But when you pass those 10 questions, they are like, how many branches are there in the federal government? Who is the first president of the United States? 91% of the people that take that test pass. 91% of naturalized prospective citizens pass. The same test was essentially given to people all over the country who are native-born. And in only one state, Vermont, could a majority of citizens pass that test, which shows you people born here don't know much about our government. And the theory of a representative democracy, as Jefferson would say, is you have to have an informed citizenry. Thomas Jefferson believed that if the citizenry is informed, you can have a better representative democracy. So what I'm trying to do with patriotic philanthropy is to inform people a little bit better about the way our country operates and our history, on the hope that that might lead to a more representative and better government.
Yeah. Education is the key to many, many things. And
education is the key to people's success. Now, you can drop out of college like Bill Gates and you get lucky, and Mark Zuckerberg dropped out of college, but most people are not going to be Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg. Getting as much education as you can is really the key to success in the Western world as we know it.
Yeah. David, you made also another fairly big time and money investment recently with the purchase of Baltimore Orioles. As a kid growing up, was this always your dream?
Well, I was growing up in Baltimore, and the Orioles were obviously our hometown baseball team, and I idolized them like many young people do when they're young, particularly young boys at that time, idolized their teams. This wasn't a lifelong passion necessarily, but I've tried to give back to our country with some of my philanthropic gifts, and I wanted to give back to Baltimore where I got a public school education that was very good. So I thought if I could come in and help in some ways make the team better, and it's a good team already, I would be giving back to the hometown that gave me a very good public education, where the hometown that my parents were raised at, that they were married in and that they are buried in, and the same town that I was raised in and that I will be buried in. So I wanted to do something for Baltimore.
True. My husband went to Johns Hopkins. So when we started dating, it's one of the first places he took me to Baltimore.
Well, it must be a great thing because you got married, right?
Exactly. Good.
So you come to an Orioles game?
I would love to. Although I don't know much about baseball, even though I've been in this country for a long time, but I would love to come.
Okay, well, we'll get a date and you can come.
I'd love to come. So last week you attended, I think, your first game as the owner, but I'm sure it wasn't anything but a normal opening day, as obviously the community is grappling with the collapse of this Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse you talked about. Can you maybe talk about what this bridge means to the city of Baltimore and any insights that you might have in terms of how the rebuild will take shape? You said it might take 10 years.
I met with President Biden the other day, 2 days ago, and he told me he'd be going there on Friday. And the governor, I talked to the governor yesterday, and the governor is going to be going as well with the president. And they will announce something there that I won't preempt them in talking about it. Okay. But clearly they're going to do something that will aid Baltimore. But it's a very important bridge because it's an important route around Baltimore. Many people use it to get to work every day. And of course, the bridge itself is high enough so ships are theoretically supposed to go under it. It's one of the most important ports in our country. So it's really the lifeblood, to some extent, of Baltimore. And it's a tragic loss of life and a tragic decline in the economic prosperity of Baltimore that will be affected by this for some time. Hopefully, the bridge can be rebuilt. In the meantime, we have to find ways around it and need to do something to help the people whose jobs have been lost because of this. And there'll be some announcement about that tomorrow.
Okay. Looking forward to the announcement.
Okay.
And I have one last question for you, because I always like to end our client events on an optimistic note. Despite all the challenges we talked about, the partisan divide, infrastructure, our debt, what makes you optimistic about the future of our country?
Well, that there are good money managers like UBS that are out there managing people's money, and they're making certain that people can retire with good amounts of money. So I'm always optimistic about that. I'm always optimistic that the country will come together. As Winston Churchill used to say famously, the United States will consider every option. In the end, it will finally come to the right decision. So while we have a lot of division in our country and we have a lot of political turmoil, in the end, the country will do the right thing and the government will do the right thing, I think, for the American people. So I'm optimistic about the country's future.
Yeah. That's why I guess a lot of people like me come here.
Okay, well, we have 50 million immigrants in this country. Yeah. No other country in the world has anything close to that. That's because this country is welcoming to that, to people like that. And also, they believe in the American dream. People come here really believe in the American dream, even more than people born here.
Yeah. Thank you. David, thank you so much for your time and for being here in the studio. And to all of our clients, thank you for spending the last, I guess, half hour with us. I hope that you found the discussion as insightful as I did. As always, I encourage you to follow up with your UBS financial advisor to discuss what this all means for your own portfolio. And we will continue to feature a steady stream of insights leading up to the November elections from both our CIO team and external experts, like you heard from today. For the latest, you can always visit ubs.com/electionwatch. Thank you.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.